This is day three of the New Year Retreat 2017. So today the wind is blowing. We spend a lot of time thinking about the weather. It's not necessary, really. Weather is a strong practice out here, so we just get on with it. Just take care of the silence. Often, especially in the work period, there's sort of camaraderie that arises and falls away. That's fine. Just have a sense of when it's helpful and when it isn't. But if we don't take care of the silence, then it's just a little bit harder to get momentum up in the retreat. We're always stopping to relate, always stopping to comment, always stopping to joke, always stopping to plan, whatever it is. It's like stopping and starting all the time. So if you want to really feel what it's like to do an extensive retreat, really take care of that. Doesn't mean hold on to it. Doesn't mean push it away. Just means make that part of your practice. At all times, make that part of your practice. And then the retreat will find its own life. Okay, so yesterday we we had a look at that sort of koan life, koan practice. Too important to be left in the hands of adults. So the kind of koan we were working with yesterday, Zhouzhou and the old woman in the field, like many koans, kind of requires of us to be a little less sensible and explanatory in that part of our life. And sometimes that's difficult. We live in the age of reason. Our culture is built around that. Our language is built around that. Since the so-called enlightenment of the 17th century, we've placed on a pedestal our ability to reason, to investigate, to draw conclusions, and we've done that very well, very efficiently, and the kind of pride of place in our culture is given to institutions like universities and academic status. And that's enabled us to survive, us who can't run very fast or are not strong enough, enabled us to survive and prosper in a very particular way. And it's been an evolutionary process, of course, as well. But I think we all know that it has its own Achilles heel. It's left scars on our planet and on our souls, our hearts. And to kind of balance that out instinctively, we also honor poets and musicians and painters and priests and children, because out of this very rational world in which we live is also a sense of loss and longing. And the more we are in touch with that, the more we begin to pick up clues in our life, our communal life and our own life, that speak to that part of us. And any spiritual tradition really belongs in that sphere of activity. The Dark Side of the Moon, Pink Floyd had it. Leonard Cohen's last album, You Want It Darker. You Want It Darker. You've got it. Anyway, that's another matter. So koans are just part of the Zen tradition, the Zen teaching. As you will know, not every Zen school nor every Zen teacher will use koans, and if they do, they use them in slightly different ways. And all one asks is that each teacher use it honestly and based on his own experience or her own experience. But what the koans do particularly, for me anyway, is that they insist that I don't just think about the teachings or settle in a nice comfortable place where I can sit 30 minutes at a stretch, and that's pretty much all that's required of me. 1 hour, whatever. It's, as I understand koans, it's a particular genius of theirs that they say, okay, you talk about compassion, show me. You talk about playfulness, show me. You talk about a tiger, show me. So that this is not just another theoretical exercise, or not just another peaceful alternative to reality, as it were, but that we find reality right here in our practice. And for me, that feels absolutely crucial. So we're always just being asked, how real is my practice? How real are my words? how real is this life that I am. So that's one aspect of koan work, that it just requires us to embody the teachings. And perhaps just to go back one step, that may sometimes require explanation. It may sometimes require action. It may sometimes require some kind of demonstration of or embodiment of the teaching or of the situation or of the story. And to do that, we have to just let go of the controlling self, or that function of ourselves that controls and protects and renders us safe. And that's not always easy. Most of us have got certain areas where we can be playful, or at certain times in our life we find certain things playful, but there are others always where we really are stretched in order to find that part of ourselves. I have a sister who teaches the Alexander technique, and one of the things she does as an exercise is get us all to run around like children on the lawn. I found that so difficult. I just couldn't. I just felt so self-conscious and silly. Occasionally I managed it, but she's 78. So I thought at least I owed her a little bit of cooperation there. But we all have that, and that's where our practice is. It's one thing to sit comfortably for 30 minutes. It's another thing to suddenly feel uncomfortable and say, how do I deal with this now? How do I practice here? Because my instinct is to withdraw, to protect, perhaps to blame, to lash out, to complain. To feel lacking. And that's when our practice really gets interesting. So it's never, in a very fundamental way, koan practice, or Zen practice in general, is not about succeeding or failing. It's finding out where we get stuck and practicing from there. That's the only reality of our practice. Of course, we put stuff like success and failure on top of it, right and wrong, blame, you know, not blame, failure, and all of that. We're used to those words, so they come very readily, especially to those who grew up Protestants. That kind of language is immediate to us, so our job is to wake up to that, and we have to be quite sharp sometimes. Oh, here I am, stuck, and I'm blaming myself. Well, I'm complaining about the teacher, or I'm complaining about the tradition, or whatever. It really doesn't matter what the content of that is, but that is the process that's happening there. And it's endless in a way. We're always just finding out about our life and opening and finding out where we're stuck and opening. And every time we open, there's a sense of gratitude and relief. So that's part of the koan practice. Sometimes, and remember, koans are operating in language, and language operates in terms of dualities and categories and opposition and so on and so forth. That's how language, our language anyway, functions. The language of a child is far more kind of physical or demonstrative, less based in reason and opposites or in concepts, less conceptually based. So, in some sense, becoming childlike is a very integral part of loosening the controlling self, the commenting self. And we find that in koans again and again. In the teachings in general, in fact, where words are used on the edge of meaning, as it were. Where they are used in a pointerly way, in a painterly way. Poetic way, childlike way, demonstrative way, rather than concept based. And inevitably, in that, on the edge there, words change their meaning. Contradictions appear endlessly. And part of our life is learning to live with that. That particular use of language and concept, where it often appears to be nonsensical or absurd, magical, childlike, so on. It doesn't mean that we never use language sensibly, it just means that there's an area in our life where we can expect to find contradiction. Or silence, or not knowing. So that's one aspect of our koan practice, is that at some point we have to enter someone else's story. Even if you don't do koan practice, that's part of our Zen life, to enter someone else's story, to stand in their shoes, and to embody that, not just as an idea or a nice thing to think about, but something clear. I came across a nice example of the kind of oddity of koan language this morning while looking at yesterday's koan, trying to remember something. Yesterday's koan, in a sense, is a demonstration koan. There are a number of them. Perhaps all of them in one way require demonstration, not just speech. But some of them are particularly where you're requiring some kind of demonstration to show that your answer is real. But just to come back before I move on there, I think what I said to everybody yesterday was that there's a coda in that koan, an end piece, where the Zen master shouts, roars like a tiger, And the old lady roars back at him. First of all, roaring is not the only answer, it's just her answer. You've got to find yours. But after that extraordinary sort of meeting and intimacy, Zen Master Joju says, there is still this. There is still this. And I asked us all to just sort of consider that. What is he saying? Why is he saying it? Why then? How do you respond to that? What do you think he's referring to? A slightly different kind of koan question, where it may just be more presented in terms of a verbal response. And then we could perhaps take it from there. But just, I think with some of you, I wasn't quite sure what his words were. But according to the version I have, he says, just, there is still this. There is still this. Okay, that's just in case you were wondering what the question was that I'd left you with. But I came across this lovely story this morning that reminds me of something I talked of yesterday with one of you about having family on retreats. And there's a famous Tang Dynasty, that's sort of 8th to 10th century a Chinese family, Layman Pang is his name. Layman Pang was a wealthy businessman who kind of gave up the high life to hang around with Zen masters and so on. And there are lots of stories about him and the teachers. And he had a wife who's the sort of hero of a number of stories. He has a son who I think just went out and worked all day. And the sort of star of the show is his daughter, Lin Zhao, I think her name is. Lin Zhao. And she usually is the one that kind of puts everyone straight. So they're this kind of fairy tales family, the father, the mother, the son and the daughter, all, quote, enlightened, unquote. They're kind of fairy tale figures. But one of the stories is when Layman Pang and his daughter Lin Zhao are out collecting bamboo, and as they come back over the bridge, Pang trips and falls, and his daughter just dives down and lies next to him, and he says, "What are you doing?" And she says, "I saw you fall, so I'm just helping." And he says, "Luckily no one was watching." So a feature of these stories is that the daughters outdo their fathers all the time and show them up for the loving fools they are. But again, it's one of those stories that doesn't quite make sense. So our minds say, but she's not helping him by falling down at all. Not a bit. But it's the kind of playfulness of that gesture, you know. Are you lying down? I'll lie down too. It's kind of nonsensical and endearing, and there's that quality about it. And I quite like his comment about, luckily no one was watching, because the family name will be ruined even further. But of course there's sort of explanations like that you can have given. Luckily the self was not watching and making you more self-conscious and sensible, in which case you would have behaved differently. And there's that sort of explanation stuff. If you like that, there are lots of books that'll give you that stuff. But just having someone who's willing to kind of fall down next to you, just in itself, that kind of intimacy is absurdly wonderful. So our practice asks of us to be able to drop the kind of controlling, sensible, respectable self at some times, and be willing to not know, to be ignorant, to be childlike, to step into someone's shoes. All of that requires a kind of letting go of the self. It also requires of us to pick up the self when we need it. It requires of us to plan our lives, to look after our families, to improve things, to fix things, to make this life the best we can make it. And for that we need all the powers of reason, skill and experience that we have. But if we can do both of those, then there's a freedom in us that that enables us to go from one to the other. So we can play with the grandchildren. We can draw up a bridge. We can solve a case. We can help a friend. And then the more we're able to do that, the kind of wider our life is. Wider our life can be. And there'll always be edges. We only grow at the edges. There'll always be edges for us to explore and deal with. That's not a problem. That's just how it is. But being able to do both just enables things to move a bit more freely, and especially in a country and in a time where we really need to be able to stand in each other's shoes. Then this kind of practice is not just a luxury. It's something that lies at the heart of our lives, wherever we are. Okay, so we'll meet again today, perhaps a bit quicker than yesterday, because I've met you all, and we'll look at there is still this. Thank you.